John Lennon, The Rolling Stone Interview, Part 4.
There's a point in which you decided that you'd give up your private life, and then you'll go and give up your private life.
No, we never decided to give up our private life, but we decided if we're going to do anything like get married or like this film that we're going to make now, that we would dedicate it to peace and the concept of peace. And during that period, because we are what we are, it evolved that somehow we ended up being responsible to produce peace, you know. I mean, even in our own heads we would get that way. But that's how it is, you know. But peace is still important, you know. But my life is dedicated to living, just, you know, surviving is what it's about, really, from day to day.
And we don't want to be hypocrites, you know. Like most people start to destroy their own private life and just become like a big billboard saying peace, you know, or something. But we want to sort of try to be a human as well, you know, sort of try to hold on to our life as well.
When you look back on, like, going to Amsterdam...
That was beautiful. It's like the wedding album, you know. And it was a move for peace, you know. I mean, it's no question about it.
What do you think the effects of that were?
I don't know. You see, I can't measure it, you know.
We don't know. You have to tell us.
You tell us. You're reacting. We're acting, you know. Somebody else has to tell us what the reaction is.
What happened in Denmark? During that trauma, what do you think?
Well, we sat there discussing it, you know, and...
Not that part of it. I mean, the doctor...
Hamrick was brought over by Tony, because he said this great doctor, hadn't mentioned about the flying saucers until he was on his way, almost, but that this guy was going to hypnotize us and we would stop smoking.
We thought, great. Practical.
So Tony said it really worked, because it worked on us, and it had worked. Tony and Melinda did not smoke, and he said it was easy. So he was brought over, and this sort of guy comes in, who's seemed to be primaling all the time, you know. He was always crying and that. And talking. And then he tried it, and it didn't work, you know. I mean, every time we wanted to sing, he talked like crackers, so I mean, that's what... And then he said things like, well, he put us back into our past lives, and we're game for anything then, you know. So, I mean, it's like going to a fortune teller. So we said, all right, do it. And he was mumbling, pretending to hypnotize us, and we're lying. And then he's making up all these Walt Disney stories about past lives, you know, which we didn't believe. But he was such a nice guy in a way that we didn't want to sort of say, well, we were sort of saying, well, it seems a bit strange, just I don't know. And I was more into it than Yoko. I mean, she's not quite as silly as I am. But I was thinking, well, you never know, do you? You know, I had this thing that believe everything until it's disproved, you know. And it turned from giving up ciggies into, and he was going on about he'd been on a spaceship. But watching, you know, I would say, well, come on, tell
but
us more.
You were a bit suspicious too.
Oh, I was suspicious, sure I was, you know. But I wouldn't stop the stories coming out and tell us how it was, you know. And then he'd be saying how, you know, they all think there was this harbinger. I didn't know about it, but I heard that Tony and them had been there. Tony had only gone at the end, you know. But they were obviously all insane people, you know. And then... these other two came over, I don't know what, the one in purple and the other magician, the picture of him, he said he was going to put spells on everybody and all that. It was just really crazy, and we were getting worried that by then, you know, that it was getting out of hand. But we wondered why this Hamrick, if he was such a higher being, and all of them think that they're higher beings. I mean, they're still travelling around Europe and everywhere thinking they've got messages, you know. And it's a shame. And Hamrick said he'd been on a flying saucer, but we all suspected it was somebody so spiritual and ethnic or whatever the shit. Why is he so fat? Why can't he, you know, get that together? That was the thing. And he'd say, well, because I have to get myself in a certain state of being by eating all these ice cream buns to communicate with the Martians, you know. And the poor old dear and his wife are probably up in Canada now.
Could I just say something?
Yes, you may.
No, this is something else that Dan says. Yeah. That he's checked the suit, you know, that we're supposed to move into.
Oh, yeah.
He said Navarro is better. So if you want to move into Navarro...
Navarro? We've been there once.
I know. But even Navarro is better if you want to move from Regent. He said Hilton is going to be open next week.
Why is it worse? Mm-hmm. Why are you going to tell Alan that?
Okay, I might do that.
You don't have to, but it would be an idea. We can get on to that after. I'll stay in the Regency then. I'd like to get, you know, finish it. So come on. Yeah. Oh, Jesus. But actually, we went there to talk to see Kyoko, you know. And it was another case of sort of, you know, brothers and all that, so, you know. Love me, love my dog.
You said, that talking is a better form of communication. Music is a better form.
When did I say that? I don't know. I don't know if it's true or not, you know. It's true 1 minute, not true the next.
What is it? What do you think the future is going to be?
Whatever we make it.
Why is it?
I mean, if we want to go bullshitting off into intellectualism with rock and roll, we're going to get bullshitting rock intellectualism. If we want real rock and roll, it's up to all of us to create it and stop being hyped by, you know, revolutionary image and long hair. We've got to get over that bit, you know. That's what cutting hair is about, you know. Let's own up now and see who's who and who's doing something about what and who's making music and who's laying down bullshit. It, rock and roll will be whatever we make it.
Why do you think it means so much?
Rock and roll? Because it's primitive enough and it has no bullshit, really, the best stuff. And it gets through to you. It's beat, you know. I mean, go to the jungle and they have the rhythm and it goes throughout the world. And it's as simple as that. You get the rhythm going, everybody gets into it. And it's, I think... Michael X, as he said it, but I read that Eldridge Deaver, somebody said it, that the blacks gave the middle class whites back their bodies, you know, put their minds and bodies to it. It's something like that, you know. It gets through it. To me, it got through. It was the only thing to get through to me out of all the things that were happening when I was 15, you know. Rock and roll was real. Everything else was unreal. And the thing about rock and roll, good rock and roll, whatever good means, etc., all that shit, is that it's real, you know. Mm. And realism gets through to you, despite yourself. You recognize something in it which is true, like all true art.
What is it?
Whatever art is, readers. Okay? You know, it's that. If it's real, it's simple, usually, and if it's simple, it's true. Something like that.
Mm.
Rock and roll got through to you, didn't
it?
It finally.
I was just going to say that, you know, classic music was 4-4, basically 4-4, you know, and then it went into 4-3-2, which is a waltz, you know, rhythm and all that. But it just went further and further away from the heartbeat. Heartbeat is 4-4, and it goes 1-2-3, 1-2-3, you know.
Right now.
And then they started 1-2-3, you know, all that. And then
perversion.
Their rhythm became very decorative. And then, you know, like Schoenberg, Webern, all their rhythm is like, ta-da, ta-da-ta-da, you know, like that. But the point is, it's highly complicated and interesting, and our minds are very, you know, much like that. But they lost the heartbeat, you know. And I went to see the Beatles session, you know, and in the beginning, you know, and so I was saying to John, well, why do you always use that beat all the time, the same beat, you know? Why don't you do a bit more kind of complex, you know, coming from the...
That's why I was doing Bulldog.
And he was saying, oh, she's saying that we're using the same beat all the time or something.
I went, very embarrassing.
And then I suddenly realized that's
for
what...
For yourself or for Yoko?
For me, because if somebody starts laying that intellectual on me, I'm going to think, oh, maybe...
He's a very shy fellow.
I'm shy. You know, if somebody attacks, I shrink.
Mm.
Until I've got what?
Ah, this intellectual snobbery about you.
She's an intellectual, supreme intellectual, yeah. You know. So and I really know what I'm talking about when I say those fucking intellectuals.
That, you know.
I know what they have to go through. They have to have a sort of like a maths formula, a thought pattern in their head to feel something. You can't just go. They have to go sort of. This is the result of that which did this. You know, because the programming when they were children.
The best way to explain is, I can't play the piano unless I see a score.
Which is insanity.
Right.
So
that is intellectualism, you know. And that is musicianship. You know, that's the school of music shit. to be able to not to make music unless you can read a piece of paper which has nothing to do with music.
And you feel the same, you know, the same way about rock and roll melody at 30.
Yeah.
You did when you were 15.
Well, and it'll never be as new, you know. I mean, it's never going to do what it did to me then. But like Tutti Frutti and Long Tall Sally is pretty avant-garde. I met an old avant-garde friend of Yoko's in the village the other day who was talking about one note and didn't Dylan sing one note. And, you know, like he's just discovered that. But, you know, that's about as far out as you can get, you know. And so I'm even intellectually, I can play games enough to for reasons why that music is very important and always will be. Like the blues, as opposed to jazz, you know, white, middle class, good jazz, as opposed to the blues, you know. Now, the blues is better.
Because it's simpler?
Because it's real, you know, it's like, it's not perverted or thought about in a, it's not a concept. It is an actual, it's a chair, not a design for a chair, or a better chair, or a bigger chair, or a chair with leather, or with design. It is the first chair, you know, it's chairs for sitting on.
Yes.
Not chairs for looking at or being appreciated. You know, you sit on that music.
How would you describe Beatles?
Beatle music. Well, it means a lot of things to me. You know, there's not one thing that's Beatle music, because how can I? I'm part of it. Some, you know, what is Beatle music? Walrus or Penny Lane? Which? Or, I mean, it's that diverse. Or I Want to Hold Your Hand or Revolution Number 9.
Well, what was it? What do you think it was about, like Love Me Do?
Love Me Do was rock and roll, you know, pretty funky.
What do you think? What do you think accounted for the sudden popularity of Love Me Do?
Love Me Do was never big. It might have made it over here after we'd made it. Remember that America followed much after, because we were local heroes. Love Me Do didn't only make number 40 in the charts in England. It didn't do anything, you know. And it was just.
But I mean, what was it about the sound that not to be Love Me Do, but anything that caught everybody?
Because we didn't sound like everybody else, that's all. I mean, we didn't sound like the black musicians because we weren't black, and et cetera, et cetera, and because we were brought up on a different kind of music and atmosphere. And so, Please Please Me and From Me to You and all those were our version of the chair. You know, we were building our own chairs, that's all, you know, and they were sort of local chairs. That's, I don't know.
What were the first devices and tricks that you used
The first gimmick was the harmonica. There'd been Hey Baby, mm-hmm. Right. And there was a terrible thing called I Remember You in England by some I Remember You, how'd you harmonica? And I played a lot of harmonica, mouth organ, really was, when I was a child. So we did those numbers, and so we started using it on Love Me Do, you know. And just for arrangement, because we used to work out arrangements, and we just used it, you know. And then we stuck it on Please Please Me, and then we stuck it on From Me to You, like that, you know. It went on and on, it got into a gimmick, and then we dropped it. It got embarrassing, you know.
What were the other, what sort of complexities, embellishments besides harmonica did you start to?
Well, we did that at the cabin. I was playing harmonica, but that was the gimmick in the early days, was the harmonica. I don't know what you mean, musically on the records, what did we do? The first sort of tricks was double tracking on the second album. We discovered that, or it was told to us, you can do this. And that really set the ball rolling. We really double tracked ourselves off the album on the second album. That really, apart from the first lot, we just did as a group that we went in and played. And they put it on tape. And we went, you know, they remixed it, they did everything to it. I'd love to remix some of the early stuff, you know. because it's better than it sounds.
And I'm going to cover some John.
Yes, yes, yes. She's going to do Lennon McCartney album. But you've got to do your old. You've got many. You've got so many albums.
And have you ever thought of there's a live album and there's some
Hollywood Bowl. It was pretty tatty, you know. It's nice when to hear. It'll probably go out one day, but we're so nervous, you know. Well, but why not, you know? The Hollywood Bowl was just it's always, you know, it was always like Dean Martin was in the audience and all their children. It wasn't like people anymore, you know, like that. And we were always nervous. It was like going on the Palladium, but we're there, all right, you know. There's also Shea Stadium somewhere. There's one in Italy apparently that somebody recorded there. But he always did everything 20 times faster than normal. You know.
What did you think of those concerts? Like Hollywood Bowl, like doing that?
It was awful. I hated it. Some of them were good, some weren't. I didn't like Hollywood Bowl. Because I don't know whether if we knew we were being recorded, it was death, you know. We were so frightened. And because you knew there was always terrible in your voice. There was always, you could never hear yourself. And, you know, you knew that they were fucking it up on the tape anyway, and there was no bass, and they never recorded the drums. You could never hear them. Mm-hmm. The sound, the places were built for fucking orchestras, not groups, you know. And it just wasn't. Some of those big gigs were good, but not many of them.
In rereading an interview that you did with John Cott a year or so ago, you said something about Ticket to Ride.
Yeah.
Being a favorite song.
Yeah, I liked it because it was slightly a new sound at the time. Because it was pretty fucking heavy for then. If you go and look at the charts or what other music people were making, and you hear it now, it doesn't sound too bad. It's one of them, so it doesn't make
heavy.
You cringe. If you give me the 8-track and I'll remix it, mm-hmm. I'll show you what it is really. But you can hear it there. I used to like guitars, you know. I don't want anything else on the album with guitars and jangling piano or whatever. And it's all happening. It's a heavy record, you know. And the drums are heavy too. It's that's why I like it. Yeah.
In I Am the Walrus, that's
that was the B-side of Hello Goodbye. Can you believe it?
In Glass Onion. Here's another clue for you all.
The Walrus is Paul. Well, I said this to Ray Connolly, asked me. At that time, still in my love cloud with Yoko, I thought, well, you know, I'll just say something nice to Paul that it's all right, you know, and, you know, you did a good job over these few years holding us together, and you know, he was trying to organize the group and that, you know, and do the music and be an individual artist and all that. So I wanted to say something to him, you know. And I did it for that reason, you know. I thought, well, you can have it, you know. I've got Yoko, and thank you. You can have the credit, you know.
And now you've decided.
I decided. I'm sick of between reading things about Paul is the musician and George is the philosopher. I wonder where I fit in, you know. What was my contribution? I get hurt, you know. I'm sick of it. So I'd sooner be like Zappa and say, listen, you fuckers. This is what I did, you know, and I don't care whether you like my attitude saying it, but that's what I am, you know. I'm a fucking artist, man, and I'm not a fucking PR agent or the product of some other person's imagination, whether you're the public or whatever, you know. I'm standing by my work, whereas before I would not stand by it, you know. So that's what I'm saying. I was the walrus, whatever that means. We saw the movie in LA, and the walrus was a big capitalist that ate all the fucking oysters. If you must know, that's what he was. I always had this image of the walrus and Carpenter. It was all, you know, I loved it and that. And so I didn't never check what the walrus was. I'm going out to I'm the walrus, you know, as if it's something, but he's a fucking bastard. That's what it turns out to be. But, I mean, the way it's written, everybody presumes that it means something, you know. I mean, even I did, so, I mean, we all just presume, just because I said I am the walrus, that it must mean I'm God or something. But it was just poetry, you know. But it became symbolic with me.
What other little things are there like that?
The walrus, so I don't know. I said hello to Peter Brown in Ballad of John and Yoko, because it's just a way of thanking them, you know. Because I learned things from Yoko in a way. They always dedicate their work, these avant-garde people, to each other, you know, like this is for David Tudor and this is for that. And they're grateful for the original. The whole book's dedicated to all these men, and I wouldn't let her put it in the real one. But now I understand it a bit better. I thought they were all sort of...
No, it wasn't anything special.
I know, but they always, you know... They it says, you know, like, say it was, like, I've dedicated the album to Yoko, but they dedicate, like, you know, Isolation for George, or Isolation for Jan, you know, just because you were around when we spoke or something like that. It's nice, you know, they did that to each other. And so it's a bit like that, you know.
With a drop of a hat they did, you know.
Yes. I understand. He understands, don't worry.
You know,
they were just in the group, and they did a lot of that, so I just sort of picked up on it, I suppose. And I'm very, sort of full. I want people to love me. I want to be loved.
What did you think of Abbey Road?
I liked the A side. I never liked that sort of whatever pop opera on the other side. Yeah. I think it's junk.
It was one of the most sort of fragmented things.
Yeah, because it was just bits of song thrown together, you know, and I can't remember what's on there. It said Come Together, though, I remember, and something's on it.
That
yeah, that was my song, you know. So that's all I remember. What, did I do anything else on Abbey Road? Come Together? One? Don't tell me. I couldn't be an album with just one track on.
No.
Anyway, I it was a competent album, like Rubber Soul, in a way, you know what I mean? It was... together in that way, but it had no life really.
How did you compose Come Together? How did that?
I can't say this for being sued, you see. See, Rosemary, this is different. The Learys wanted me to write, this is not the suing bit, the Learys wanted me to write them a campaign song, and their slogan was Come Together.
And you do, right?
I wrote it, I've still got it. It's actually very like the Kinks Drive, you know, some song of theirs. But anyway, I wrote Come Together. But before I wrote their song, I was writing in the office, just sort of... I can't say this because we're going to get sued because it's silly. But I was writing this, like, You Can't Catch Me, you know, the same rhythm, and using the old words. I often do it, you know, like... If I'm trying to write one light long tall Sally, or I'm just singing, I'm going... Oh, well, let's do a dummy fit. No, go on and tell one Mary and just make up, change paradise the words. I was doing that, and then when I got, I stopped and then said, just came out, Come Together, because Come Together was rolling around in my head. Right now, Over Me, and Over Me was meant to be like a joke, like, Over Me, like Elvis used to, Over You. But people arrived in London saying, you said Come Together Over Me, and I'm here. You know, and I thought, oh, well, so that was like that. And then I never put the other one went, Come together and join the party. Come together and join the party. You know, for Leary, like give peace a chance, chant along thing.
Leary doesn't know, but we should send that.
Yeah, I know, but it's so I never get around to it. So I never did it, and I end up writing Come Together instead. And they're suing me because it's like You Can't Catch Me, you know, for the first half a line or something. Because Chuck Berry's words went... Something like that, you know. But anyway, it's not him that's suing, it's his people. So you have to not put that in because they'll say, oh, well, he's admitted it, you know. Yes. And I think it's a compliment to Chuck Berry, not a fucking... I mean, we resurrected him.
On instant karma is like the changes of volume is love.
Well, there's many songs that are similar. It's because I'm full of... I always like to say where the source was. I say, well, that was from You Can't Catch Me, but if I never said anything, nobody'd ever know. Just one guy spotted it. But there's many songs in the same chain. The chorus isn't the same. The only thing is it goes, down, 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 down. But many of them do. It's like millions of songs go down, 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 down. All those, you know, Whiter Shade of Pales and just thousands of songs.
What was it like doing Instant Karma?
Recording it. It was great, you know. Because I wrote it in the morning on the piano, like I've said many times, and I went to the office and I sang it. I thought, hell, let's do it. And we booked the studio, and Phil came in. He said, how do you want it? I said, you know, 1950, but now. He said, right, and boom, I did it in about three goes or something, and went in, and he played it back, and there it was, you know. And only argument, I said, a bit more bass, that's all, and off we went, you know. See, Phil's a real, he's great at that. He doesn't fuss about with, you know, fucking stereo or, you know, all the bullshit, you know. Just does it sound all right? Let's have it. It doesn't matter whether something's prominent or not prominent. If it sounds good to you as a layman or as a human, take it. Don't bother whether this is like that or, you know, the quality of this. Just take it, and that suits me fine. Yeah, we're just finishing.
Could I have you for a minute?
Yeah. In there?
Yeah.
Have we finished?
I'd like to know more, but we can take a break. I'd like to call Manny and have a moment.
Oh, I don't want to, really. You know, because nobody's done it. I don't want to start all that pictures of John and Yoko, but let's take one with an Instamatic. You can take it, and you can take it.
That'd be terrible.
It won't be terrible. Look at the album. Take it. Don't be a snob. Don't be professional. Just take a photo.
right back.
Yeah.
When did you first become aware of the idea of stereo, of being able to work with stereo?
Sometime or other, I don't know. Let me think. Well, I don't know, there was a period where we started realizing that you could go and remix it yourself, you know, and we'd start listening to them or saying, well, why can you do that? You know, we'd be just standing by the board saying, oh, well, what about that? And George Martin saying, well, how do you like this? You know, in the early days, they just would present us with finished product. We'd say, what happened to the bass or something? They say, oh, well, that's how it is, you know, you can, you know, that kind of thing. And then, so it must have been a gradual thing, like...
Was Rubber Soul the first album you had control of?
I think so, yes, you know, full control. Yeah. Well, we'd take control in as much that we'd say, you know, this is what I want, you know, on mine, and it should be like that, and et cetera, et cetera. I'm guessing, you know, I mean, if it sounds like it, that's when it happened. I mean, there's an obvious difference in the...
On that Give Peace a Chance, what do you think of that?
As a record, I thought it was beautiful.
Did you ever see the moratorium day in Washington?
Oh yeah, I mean that's what it was for, you know.
Did you see that scene?
I think I heard it. I don't know. I just remember hearing them all singing. I don't know whether it was on the radio or TV, you know. But I mean, that was a very big moment for me. You know, that's what the song was about. You know, I wanted to. You see, because I'm shy and aggressive, you know, so I have great hopes for what I do, my work, and I also have great despair that it's all pointless and it's shit and, you know, how can you top Beethoven or what, Shakespeare or whatever, you know, I go through all that. And in my secret heart, I wanted to write something that would take over We Shall Overcome, you know. I don't know why, that's the one they always sang. I thought, why isn't somebody writing one for the people now? You know, that's what my job is. Our job is to write for the people now, you know. So the songs that they go and sing on their buses even. And not just love songs. I had the same kind of hope for Working Class Hero, you know. But I know it's a different concept. But I feel as though it's like... I think it's a revolutionary song. It's really... just revolutionary, you know. I just think its concept is revolutionary, and I hope it's for workers and not for tarts and fags, you know. I hope it's about what Give Peace a Chance was about, you know. But I don't know, you know. On the other hand, it might just be ignored, you see. I think it's for the people like me who are working class, whatever the upper or lower, who are supposed to be processed into the middle classes, you know, or into through the machinery. That's all. This is it's my experience. And I hope it's just a warning to people, working class hero.
Yeah. Oh, that's a fantastic.
No, but I don't want praise. I'm saying it. It's a. I think it's a revolutionary song. You know, not the song itself. Yeah, it's a song for the revolution.
Do you have a feeling? Can you deliberately put out a commercial record? I mean, can you have a feeling for a number one record?
No. See, I keep thinking Mother is a commercial record. I don't know. Because all the time I was writing it, it was the one that was singing the most. It's the one that seemed to catch on in my head. I'm convinced that Mother's a commercial record. But
I agree.
You agree? Well, thank you. But you said God.
No, I didn't.
No. Well, they're all playing God. Oh, Isolation. But if you start saying Isolation, well, that's it. Well, maybe.
But you're right about Mother because it's the one that I have in my head all the time.
Yeah, right.
Trust your insight. Put that out.
Yeah, but there's politics in it, too. But politics is what politics will prepare the ground for my album, the same as Oh My Sweet Lord prepared the ground for George's. Mm. I'm not going to get hits just like that. People aren't going to buy my album just because Rolling Stone liked it, mm-hmm. or because they're going to play it tonight because Pete's a good pusher. You know, people have got to be hyped in a way, they've got to have it presented to them in all the best ways that possible. You know. And if love can, because I like the song Love, you know, I think I like the melody and the words and everything. I think it's beautiful, you know. But I'm more of a rocker, that's all. I originally conceived of Mother and Love as being a single, you know. But now that I think Mother's, you know, but I don't want to. I want to put one out with her. Then I have to get rid of one, you know. But I think Love is. I agree with him, you know, love will do me more good.
I don't think so. I'd say trust your instinct as a part of me.
Well, I wasn't...
The instinct, and also, the thing is, Mother, that's what it is, what stays in your head the longest. I mean, what will stay in your head the longest?
No, but if you haven't heard, if you hear love more, that will stay in your head more. I mean, love is also commercial.
I've heard it all the same number of times, and Mother is the one that still I always have in mind.
Yeah, I understand that, but if you don't take them all at once and you just take Love, it's a single song, it's a single record. Mother is a single, Love's a single, God could be, so could Isolation and Remember.
And
I write singles, I don't write, I write them all the same way, you know. But Mother, you've got to take into account the lyrics too. If I can capture more sales by singing about love than singing about my mother's and crying, you know, I'll do it.
Because that would open a door for...
I'm opening a door for John Lennon, you know, not for music or for the Beatles or for a movement or anything.
That's a good...
I'm presenting myself to as broad a scope as I can. And I'm talking out what I think... as a result of them saying this to me, you know. There's also many little side lines like, this is not for publication, like Capital are trying to say that this isn't Plastic Ono record, you know. Oh, but Love, that has nothing to do with Love, actually. Oh, they're trying to now say that this is John Lennon, one of the Beatles, and therefore it's a different deal, you see. When they thought I was not, you know, when they were on the McCartney bandwagon, which they were on, and they thought that I was just an idiot pissing about with the Japanese broad and the music we were making, like Toronto, they didn't want to put out because they didn't like that, and all that. They were content to let me be a Plastic Ono band and give me a release on it, a special release I have to get, because the Beatles are tied up as Beatles, you know, or as individual performers.
What are the implications?
The implications are that money, all of it's money, man. And they're all just, they're being hypocrites. Now they're saying, well, you know, it looks like this is a John Lennon album, not Plastic Ono. Well, to me, it's Plastic Ono, you know. Or I wouldn't put it out like that. So that's another reason to put us out together like that. There's all those things. But I'm going to think about love, you know. You see, the original idea was there's not enough things on the album to put out a single, you know, because there's only 10 songs, really, 9 if you don't count Mummy. And that means that there's nothing to buy then, you know. But to me, it sounds like there's 40 songs on it, you know. It just sounds...
Very heavy.
But there's that side of the market. I'm not going to disregard it, you know. I'm in to sell as many albums as I can, you know, and as many records as I possibly can, because I'm an artist who wants everybody to love me and everybody to buy my stuff, you know. And I'll go for that, you know, without selling out anymore, you know.
Just I've got a film like this.
Do that. Yes, you were.
The theory of putting out something that's commercial,
yes,
to get people to buy the album, of course, is that obvious.
Yes.
No great shakes about that theory.
It's to counterbalance.
Which is most commercial?
Yeah, but it's
love
to,
or mother.
But in
which,
the no, but which how quick do you get to number one? The thing is, love will attract more people. Because of the message, man. There's many, many people who are not like mother. They don't, it hurts them. The first thing that happens to you when you get the album is you can't take it. Everybody's reacted exactly the same. They think, fuck, you know. That's what everybody does. And the second time they can just, they start saying, oh, well, there's a little, you know. So if I lay mother on them, it confirms the suspicions that something nasty is going on with that John Lennon and his broad again. You know, to the just, the, see, people aren't that hip. There aren't, you know, students aren't that aware and all that bullshit. They're just like everybody else. They, oh, what misery, you know. Is that what it's... Don't tell me it is really awful.
Why is he attacking his mother?
Why, you know, be a good boy now, John. Or that, you know, you had a hard time, but me and my mother, you know. So there's all that to go through. Love is I wrote it in a spirit of love. In all that shit, I wrote it in a spirit of love. It's for Yoko. It has all that connotation for me. And it's a beautiful melody. And I'm not even known for writing melody. There's all that angle. Mm. Also, people would hear it, and they'd hear all this shit about what the shit that's going on. And it's banned, and he wrote, and it's all, he doesn't believe in God, and we're the Kennedys, and my God, what do you know, all that. That I'm going to get that, you know. This will sort of say, well, you know, in amongst that, you know, in life there is that, you know. There's that too, you know. I'm very good. I really convinced myself
that. It's true, though.
It's,
you know,
true, though. You've got to think of that, you know.
For everything, you know.
I mean, phew, yes. But I'll still consider it.
Mother, people think it's too
It'll do
personal.
Me good, you know. If it goes, it'll do me good. Go on.
Did you write most of the stuff
that
is down on guitar?
The ones where I play guitar, I wrote them on guitar. The ones where I play piano, I wrote on piano.
What do you think of the difference between a piano song and a guitar song?
Well, let's think of the difference between I Found Out and Remember something. Or there's more piano ones on this one than guitar, isn't there? I think.
What are the differences to you when you write them?
Because I can play piano even worse than I play guitar. So that's a limited palette, as they call it, you know. And so I surprise myself, you know. I mean, I have to think in terms of go from C to A, you know, like that. And I'm not quite sure where I am half the time. And when I'm holding a chord, I go ding. And it might only be an ordinary, on the guitar, it's only a sixth or a seventh or something like that. On the piano, I don't know what it is, you know. I know it's it's something like that. So it's that kind of feel about it, you know. But with the guitar, I know such a lot about the guitar, you know, with guitar I can be busking, or if I just, I don't know, you know, or if I want to write a sort of, just a rocker, I have to play guitar because I can't play piano well enough to inspire me to rock, you know. It's like that. That's the difference, really.
What do you think are your best songs?
Ever.
Ever. What is the best song?
The one best song.
Have you thought of that?
I don't know. I don't know. Is it like somebody asked me what's my favourite song? You know, like, is it Stardust or something like that? I can't. It's that kind of decision making I can't make. I like, I always like Walrus, Strawberry Fields, Help, In My Life, Those are some favorites, you know.
Why help?
Because I meant it. It's real. The lyric is as good now as it was then. It's no different, you know. And it makes me feel secure to know that I was that sensible or whatever, you know. That not sensible, but aware of myself. Then that's when, with no acid, no nothing, you know. Pot or whatever. That didn't mean a thing, really. You know? It was just me singing help, and I meant it, you know. I don't like the recording that much. The song I like, you know. We did it too fast to try and be commercial and all that. You know. There's some song, I like I Want to Hold Your Hand, you know. We wrote that together. It's a beautiful melody. I might do I Want to Hold Your Hand and Help Again, you know. Because I like them, I sing them, you know. They're the kind of songs I sing.
Why Strawberry Fields? Again, because that was real?
Because it's real, yeah, you know. I mean, it was real for then, and it's like talking, you know. I sometimes think no, but then again, I mean, I say, you know, like that. You see, it's like that Elton John one where he's singing. I don't know. He talks to himself, sort of singing, which I thought was nice. You know, it reminded me of that.
Sounds like Girl.
I like that one. Girl, Run for My Life. I always hated. You know, I don't know, because it was one of them I knocked off just to write a song. You know, and it was phony, but Girl's real. There's no such thing as the girl. She was a dream, you know. But the words are all right, you know. It's about what she taught when she was young, that pain would lead to pleasure. Did she understand it? All that. The sort of philosophy quotes was reasonable. I was thinking about it, you know, when I wrote it. It wasn't just a song. And it was about, you know, that girl that happened to turn out to be Yoko in the end, but the one that a lot of us were looking for, you know. There's many songs I forget like that, you know, that I do like. But I like Across the Universe too.
Why?
Because it's one of the best lyrics I've written, you know. In fact, it could be the best, I don't know. I mean, it's one of the best. It's good poetry, you know, or whatever you call it. Without tune, it stands. The ones I like are ones that stand as words, you know, without melody. They don't have to have any melody. You know. It's a poem, you know, you could read them.
That's your ultimate criterion?
No, it's just the ones I happen to like, you know. I like it when I like to read other people's lyrics too, you know.
So what happened with Let It Be?
Well, it was another one like Magical Mystery Tour that... Well, it's hard to say. In a nutshell, Paul wanted to make, it was time for another Beatle movie or something. He wanted us to go on the road or do something, you know. And as usual, George, I'm like, no, we don't want to do it, fucking all that. And he sort of set it up, and there was all discussions about where to go and all that. And I would just tag along, and I had Yoko by then. I didn't even give a shit about nothing, you know. And I was stoned all the time, too, on H, etc. And I just didn't give a shit, you know, and nobody did, you know. And, you know, it's like in the movie when I go to do Across the Universe, Paul yawns, you know, and plays boogie, and I immediately say, oh, does anybody want to do a fast one? You know, that's how I am, you know. So that, year after year, that begins to wear you down.
How long does sessions last?
Oh, fucking, God knows how long. Paul had this idea that we were going to rehearse first. He's more like Simon and Garfunkel, you know, like looking for perfection all the time. And so he has these ideas that we'll rehearse and then make the album, you know. And of course, we're lazy fuckers, and we've been playing for 20 years, for fuck's sake. We're grown men, we're not going to sit around rehearsing, you know. And I'm not, anyway. We couldn't get into it. You know. And we put down a few tracks, and nobody was in it at all. I don't know. It was just a dreadful, dreadful feeling in Twickenham studio and being filmed all the time, you know, like that. I just wanted them to go away, and we'd be there at 8 in the morning, and you couldn't make music at 8 in the morning or 10 or whatever it was, in a strange place with people filming you and coloured lights, you know.
How did it end?
So the tape ended up like the bootleg version. We let Glyn Johns remix it. We didn't want to know. We just left it to him and said, here, do it. It's the first time since the first album, we didn't have anything to do with it. We just said, do it, you know. Glyn Johns did it. None of us could be bothered going in Nepal. Nobody called anybody about it, and the tapes were left there, and we got an acetate each, and we called each other and said, well, what do you think? Oh, let it out. We were going to let it out with that, with a really shitty condition, you know, disgusted. And I didn't care. I thought it was good to go out to show people what had happened to us, you know, like, this is where we're at now. We can't get it together. We don't play together anymore, you know. Leave us alone. And Glyn Johns did a terrible job on it now, because he's got no idea, etc. Never mind. He hasn't, really. And so the bootleg version is what it was like. And you know, Paul was probably thinking, well, I'm not going to fucking work on it. There was 29 hours of tape. It was like a movie, you know. I mean, just so much tape. 10-20 takes of everything, because we were rehearsing and taking everything, you know. Nobody could face looking at it. So when Spectre came around, it was like, you know, well, all right, if you want to work with us, you know, go and do your audition, man. Do. And it was, he worked like a pig on it. I mean, it was, he'd always wanted to work with the Beatles, and he was given the shittiest load of, you know, badly recorded shit and with a lousy feeling to it ever. And he made something out of it. It wasn't fantastic, but it was, you know, when I heard it, I didn't puke. I thought, oh, you know, I was so relieved after hearing 6 months of this, like, black cloud hanging over that this was going to go out, you know. I thought it would be good to go out, the shitty version, because it would break the Beatles, you know, it would break the myth, you know. Look, that's what we're, that's us with no trousers on and no glossy paint over the cover and no, you know, sort of hype. This is what we're like with our trousers off, so, you know, would you please end the game now? But that didn't happen, and Paul wouldn't, well, not wouldn't, we ended up doing Abbey Road quickly and putting out something slick to preserve the myth.
Why?
To preserve the myth.
Paul,
well, no, it's not like that, but if it's suggested, I will go along. I'm weak as well as strong, you know. And I wasn't going to fight for Let It Be, because I really couldn't stand it, you know.
But there was, finally when Let It Be was going to be released, Paul at that point wanted to release his album.
Well, yeah, I don't know that. Well, I don't quite, you know, it's so many clashes, you know. It did come out at the same time or something, didn't it?
Yeah.
I think he wanted to show he was the Beatles, you know.
By bringing out McCartney?
I think so, you know.
Were you surprised when you heard it, at what he had done?
Yeah, I was surprised it was so poor, you know.
What did you expect, a full scale?
Well, not a full scale. I expected just a little more, you know. I mean, because if Paul and I are sort of disagreeing, and I feel weak, I think he must feel strong, you know, that's in an argument. Oh, not that we've had a much physical argument, you know, or mental one out talking, but you expect the opposition, so-called. So I was just surprised, you know. And I was glad too, you know. I suddenly got it all in perspective, you know.
What do you think Paul was thinking about?
I think it'll probably scare him, you know, into doing something decent. And then he'll scare me into doing something decent, and I'll scare him like that. I don't think... I think he's capable of great work, you know. I think he will do it. I wish he wouldn't, you know. I wish nobody would, Dylan or anybody, you know. I mean, in my heart of hearts, I wish I was the only one in the world, you know, or whatever it is. But I can't see him doing it twice.
What was it like to go on tour and I read this as something Derek wrote, and people, and cripples coming up to you?
Well, I mean, that was our version of what was happening. It got that, you know, people were sort of touching us as we walked past, that kind of thing. And wherever we went, we were supposed to be not sort of like normal, you know, whatever. We were supposed to put up with all sorts of shit from Lord Mayors and their wives and be touched and poured like Hard Day's Night, only a million more times. No, like at the American Embassy, the British Embassy in Washington here, or wherever it was, with some bloody animal cut Ringo's hair, you know, in the middle of... I walked out of that, you know, swearing at all of them, and I just left in the middle of it. But I've forgotten, you tripped me off onto that. What was it? What was the question?
The cripples.
Oh, yeah. And wherever we went on tour, like in Britain or wherever we went, there's always a few seats laid aside for cripples and people in wheelchairs like that. But it got to that, because we were famous, we were supposed to have people, sort of epileptics and, you know, whatever they are, in our dressing room all the time, you know. We're supposed to be sort of good, you know. And it's just... you wanted to be alone, and you don't know what to say, you know. I mean, because they usually say, "I got your record," or they can't speak or something, and they just want to touch you. And it's always their mother or their nurse pushing them on you. They would just say hello and go away, but there's this sort of, like, they push them at you like you're Christ or something, or as if you, there's some aura about you which will rub off on them, you know. And it just got to be like that. We got very sort of callous about it, you know. It was just dreadful, you know. I mean, you'd open up every night, instead of seeing kids there, you'd just see a row full of cripples on the front, you know. All just sort of... It was just like that when we were running through, people would be lining... It seemed like just surrounded by cripples and blind people all the time. And when we'd go through corridors, everybody they'd be all touching us, you know. It got like that. It got horrifying.
You must have been, like, still fairly young and naive at that point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as naive as in his own right, you know,
and,
which is...
Surely that must have, you know, made you think for a second.
About what? No, I mean, we knew what the game was. You know, the game is the same.
I mean, it didn't astound you at that point to see that you were supposed to be able to...
Well, that was a glib way of saying what was going on. It was that sort of the in-joke that we were supposed to cure them, you know, is the kind of thing that Derek would say, because it's a cruel thing to say. I mean, we felt sorry for them like anybody would, you know, and it was... awful, but there's a kind of embarrassment when you're surrounded by sort of blind, deaf and crippled people, and there's only so much we could say, you know, with the pressure on us to perform and things like that. But it just built up, the bigger we got, the more unreality we had to face, you know, the more we were expected to do, until when you didn't sort of shake hands with the mayor's wife, she starts abusing you and screaming, or saying, "How dare they?" And there's one of Derek's stories, or where we were asleep after the session, you know, in the hotel somewhere in America, and the mayor's wife comes and says, "You know, get them up. I want to meet them," you know. And Derek said, "I'm not going to wake them up." And she starts saying, "You get them up, or I'll tell the press." And it was always that. They were always threatening what they would tell the press about us, you know, the bad publicity if we didn't see their bloody daughter and were there. Braces on her teeth, and it was always the police chief's daughter and the Lord Mayor's daughter, all the most obnoxious kids, because they got the most obnoxious parents, you know, we were forced to see all the time, and we had these people thrust on us, you know. And that was the most humiliating experiences for all those, for me, like sitting with the governor of the Bahamas because we're making help, and being insulted by these fucking jumped up middle class bitches and bastards who would be commenting on our working classness, you know, and our manners. And I was always drunk, like the typical, whatever it is, insulting them. You know, I couldn't take it. It would hurt me, so I would go insane, swearing at them and whatever. I'd always do something, you know, that would... I couldn't take it. It was awful, you know. And all that business was awful, you know. It was a fucking humiliation. We had to... One has to completely humiliate oneself to be what the Beatles were. And that's what I resent, you know. I mean, I did it. But I didn't know, I didn't foresee that, you know, it just happened bit by bit, and you gradually, till this complete craziness is surrounding you, and you're doing exactly what you don't want to do with people you can't stand, the people that you hated when you were 10. And that's what I'm saying in this album. I'm saying, I remember what it's all about now, you fuckers. You know, fuck you all. That's what I'm saying, you know, fuck you all. You know, you don't get me twice.
Will you take it all back?
What?
Being a Beatle?
If I could be a fucking fisherman, I would. You know, if I had the capabilities of being something other than I am, I would. It's no fun being an artist, you know. It isn't, you know what it's like writing. It isn't fun. It's torture. You know, and all the, I read about Van Gogh or Beethoven, any of the fuckers, you know. And I read an article the other day, well, if they'd had psychiatrists, we wouldn't have had, you know, Gauguin's great pictures, you know, and these fucking bastards, you know, they're just sucking us to death. But all we can do is do it like fucking circus animals. I resent being an artist. In that respect, I resent performing for fucking idiots who don't know anything. They can't feel. I'm the one that's feeling, because I'm the one expressing what they are trying to. They live vicariously through me and other artists, and we are the ones that, like, even with the boxers, they, when Ringo come in the ring, Oscar comes in the ring, they're booing the shit out of him. He only hit Clay once, they're all cheering him, you know. That's what I resent, you know. I'd sooner be in the audience, really, but I'm not capable of it. You know, one of my big things is I wish I was a fucking fisherman. I know it sounds silly, and I'd sooner be rich than poor and all the rest of that shit, but the pain, I'd sooner not be. I wish I was, ignorance is bliss or something, you know. If you don't know, man, there's no pain. Oh, but probably there is, but that's how, you know, that's how I express it. It's shit.
What do you think the effect of the Beatles was on the history of Britain?
I don't know about on the history. I mean, the people are in control and in power, and the class system and the whole bullshit bourgeois scene is exactly the same, except there's a lot of fag fucking middle class kids with long hair walking around London in trendy clothes, and Kenneth Tynan's making a fortune out of the word fuck. But apart from that, nothing happened, but we all dressed up. The same bastards are in control, the same people are running everything. It's exactly the same. They hyped the kids and the generation. There's been a, we've grown up a little, all of us, and there has been a change, and we are a bit freer and all that, but it's the same game. Nothing's really changed, you know. It's the same history of Britain. Shit, they're doing exactly the same thing, selling arms to South Africa, killing blacks on the street, people are living in fucking poverty with fucking rats crawling over them. It's the same, you know. It just makes you puke, and I woke up to that too, you know. That dream is over. It's just the same. Only I'm 30, and a lot of people have got long hair, that's all.
Very heavy, isn't it?
I mean, that's what it is, man. Nothing happened except for we grew up, you know. We did our thing, just like they were telling us, well, you kids, you know, it's exactly the same. Most of the so-called now generation are getting in a job and all that. Nothing changed. We're a minority, you know. We're a minority, like people like us always were. But we're a slightly larger minority because of something or other.
And what I respect about John's music is, like, you know, it's very real. You know how people tell children about Santa Claus and all that, you know. And, you know, when you start not to believe in Santa Claus and all that shit. But the thing is, you know, like George Harrison, that the only thing that I object is that he's still saying Santa Claus is there, you know, all that.
But that he, that's nothing.
But he's just saying.
But that's a question of age or whatever, you know, or the his. He can't. He believes it, you know. It's not a conscious choice. He's 25 or something.
You know, but it's just that, you know, that the fact is.
Yeah, but it's not good.
Know,
don't compare it with George.
Oh,
you know?
Okay, I mean, I won't compare it with George. But
we're not talking about that anyway. We're talking about social revolution in England. What? Yeah. No, it's hard not to compare with George, even for us. But I don't want to be compared with George. You know, why should I be compared with George?
You're right.
You know, my music has nothing to do with George's.
Why do you think the impact of the Beatles is so much bigger in America than it was in England?
The same as American stars are so much bigger in England, I suppose. I don't know, because it's grass is greener, and we really were professional by the time we got here. We learnt the whole game, you know. When we arrived here, we knew how to handle press. The British press are the toughest in the world. We could handle anything. We were all right. I know on the plane over, I was thinking, oh, we won't make it. Or I said it on a film somewhere, you know. But that's the side, that's that side. We knew we would wipe them out if we could just get a grip on you, you know. So we were new, and we didn't look. I mean, when we got here, you were all walking around in fucking Bermuda shorts with Boston crew cuts and you know, stuff on your teeth. And now they're telling us they're all saying, well, Beatles are passe, and this is like that, man. Mm. You know, and the chicks looked like fucking 1940s horses, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, there was no conception of dress or any of that jazz, you know. I mean, we just thought, what an ugly race. What an ugly race with you know, it looked just disgusting. You know? And we thought how hip we were, you know. But, of course, we weren't. It was just the five of us, you know, us and Mick, you know, were really the hip ones or something. The rest of England is just the same as it ever was. But you tend to get nationalistic. We used to really laugh at America, you know, except for its music. And it was the black music we dug. You know, and over here, even the blacks were laughing at people like Chuck Berry and the blues singers. The blacks thought it wasn't sharp to dig the really funky black music. And the whites only listened to Jan and Dean and all that. And, you know, I mean, we felt like listen to this music, you know. I mean, it was the same in Liverpool. We felt very exclusive and underground in Liverpool, listening to Ritchie Barrett and Barrett Strong and all those old-time records that nobody was listening to anywhere except for Eric Burton in Newcastle and Mick Jagger in London. It was that lonely, you know. It was fantastic. And we came over here and it was the same. You know, nobody was listening to rock and roll or to black music in America. And we felt as though we thought we were coming to the land of its origin, but nobody wanted to know about it.
Why did you make Revolution?
Which one?
Both.
Three of them. There's three.
Starting with the single.
The single. When George and Paul and all them were on holiday, I made Revolution, which is on the LP, and Revolution number 9. I wanted to put it out as a single, but they said it wasn't good enough. They came home, I had it all prepared, and they came back and said it wasn't good enough, and we put out what? Hello, Goodbye, or some shit, I don't know. No, we put Hey Jude, sorry, which was worth it, but we could have had both, you know. Mm. I wanted to put out what I felt about Revolution. I thought it was about time we fucking spoke about it, the same as I thought it was about time we stopped not answering about the Vietnamese War on tour with Brian, you know, when we had to tell him we're going to talk about the war this time, we're not going to just waffle. And I wanted to say what I thought about Revolution. I'd been thinking about it up in the hills in India, and I still had this, you know, God will save us feeling about it, you know, it's going to be all right. But even now I'm saying, hold on, John, it's going to be all right, otherwise I won't hold on, you know. But that's why I did it, you know. I wanted to say my piece about Revolution, you know. I wanted to tell you or whoever listens and communicate and say, what do you say, you know, this is what I say. And that's what I said. And on one version I said, about violence in or out, because I wasn't sure. But the version we put out said, count me out, I think. Because I don't fancy a violent revolution happening all over. I don't want to die, you know. But I begin to think that, well, what else can happen, you know. I mean, it seems inevitable.
A violent revolution?
Yeah. And the Revolution number 9 was a unconscious picture of what I actually think will happen when it happens. You know? That was just a drawing of revolution, you know. Wow. So I was hoping, what? Because arbitrarily, I was making, all the thing was made with loops. Mm-hmm. I had about 30 loops going and fed them onto one basic track. And one loop that I was getting like Beethoven and that from upstairs and chopping it up and making it backwards and things like that to get sound effects. And one thing was an engineer's test thing, and they come on talking. I said, this is EMI test series number 9, you know, like that. So I just cut off whatever he said, and I had number 9. And 9 is, I know, it turned out to be my birthday and my lucky number and everything, but I didn't realize it. It was just so funny, the voice went, number 9. So it was like a joke, you know, bringing number 9 in all the time. That's all it was.
It turns out to be that. Highest number,
among,
you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
8, 9, yes. It's many symbolic things about it, but it just happened, you know, that it was an engineer's tape, and I was just using all the bits, like to make a montage, you know. But I really wanted that out, you know. But never mind. So that's how I feel. And I know the Chairman Mao bit, I always feel a bit strange about, you know, because I thought that if they're going to get hurt, you know. The idea was, don't aggravate the pig by waving the thing that aggravates the red flag in his face, you know. I really thought that, you know, that love would save us all, you know. But now I'm wearing a Chairman Mao badge, so that's where it's at, you know. I'm just beginning to think he's doing a good job, you know.